Chapter 25. As more and more time went by, so Ozzy's confusion grew. He simply did not understand the planet they were on. For a start, the climate didn't change. It was always the same muggy warmth, with a slow breeze continually blowing in the same direction. With a tide-locked planet, there should have been strong winds redistributing the heat received by the sunside to the cold of the dark side. Big circulation currents that would blow perpetually around the globe. Not this gentle zephyr. Of course, the island could be situated in the middle of a doldrum zone, which meant the winds were actually out there, somewhere over the perturbingly distant horizon. Ozzy had set up small meteorological models in the handheld array, which broadly confirmed that theory. However, the modeling didn't take into account the fact that the planet was orbiting inside a gas halo. Quite how that would affect the atmosphere close to the surface was a complete unknown. The array certainly didn't have the kind of algorithms necessary to solve that interaction problem. Then there was the remote grey cloud bank that was just visible, squatting above the horizon. Every time they went back up the central hill to collect more wood, he checked its position. It never moved, and that was the direction from which the breeze emanated. He also made an effort to work out the distance to the nearby islands. Using the array's inertial guidance function, he measured the sight angle from both sides of the island he was on. This rough trigonometry put the closest 45 miles away, which made the planet improbably massive. The gas halo itself was an even bigger enigma. He couldn't figure out the bright specks floating around inside it. Spectrographic sensor analysis showed they were composed of water. "Does it really matter?" Orion asked as Ozzy launched into another round of muttering about the latest batch of results from his sensors. "We know we have to get to another island to find a path out of here, so who cares what's in the sky?" "Yes, it does matter," Ozzy ground out. "I don't understand how spheres of water like that form. It can't be through droplet collision. They're too big. Some of them are hundreds of miles across."
"So? You said the gas halo is breathable. Why shouldn't it have water in it?"
"That's not the point, man. You should be asking, why is it there?"
"So why is it there?"
"I don't fucking know." "It was placed there," Tochi said through his array. "Given this whole gas halo is artificial, the builders have incorporated the water spheres for a purpose." "Thank you, Tochi," Ozzy said. He turned to Orion. "And I'd like to find out what that purpose is. To do that, I need some basic information."
"Like what?"
the boy asked. "The water vapor content of the gas halo, the pressure of the gas halo. How much evaporation is going on from the water spheres, their temperature, that kind of thing. But with this equipment, I can't even get started." Ozzy waved an annoyed hand at his little collection of sensors.
"But why is it important?" Orion persisted.
"Because there are a lot of forces at work here that we can't see. If I understood more about the gas halo, I might be able to get a decent handle on this weird planet."
"It's just big, you said so. Bigger than Silvergalda."
Ozzy gave up. "Yeah, man. That's what it looks like for sure." He gave the sky, with its multitude of glinting specks, a challenging stare. "Ah, to hell with it. We've got more pressing problems, right?"
"The preparations are nearly complete," the array said. "We need one more harvesting trip for the fruit."
"Sure." Ozzy gave their completed craft a distrustful look. When they'd set about building a boat, he'd envisaged some kind of skiff with a smooth hull of tight-fitting planks, a curving sail, himself standing by the tiller steering them to the next island. After all, with his harmonic blade working again, carpentry should be easy. But the encyclopedia files in the array had been brief on actual shipbuilding techniques. They'd wound up with the kind of raft that looked about as buoyant as a brick. The first day had been spent cutting down one of each of the five tree varieties that grew on the hill, which Tochi then dragged down to the beach. One by one they were pushed out to sea. Most of the palm trunks sank lower and lower in the water as they became saturated. Only one kind floated properly, the gangly trees with their long, bushy grey fronds. Naturally the least common on the island. They had devoted the next 5 days to felling just about the entire population growing on the hill. Ozzy and Orion took turns wielding the harmonic blade, chopping the branches from the fallen trunks,
to leave relatively smooth bowls that Tochi pulled down the hill. After that stage came the rope weaving, a subject that was covered in slightly more detail by the encyclopedia files. The dried palm fronds they used were tough and sharp, and Ozzy and Orion had bleeding fingers within minutes of starting. They had to bring out the sewing kit and modify their old gloves to cope with the fronds. Even Tochi's manipulator flesh wasn't immune to the razor-like edges. Eventually, though, they had enough rope to lash the logs together. Three thick bundles, 5.5 yards long, provided the buoyancy, with a decking of more trunks at right angles holding them together. Their sail was made from the ubiquitous palm fronds woven into a square, which looked more like a piece of wicker floor matting than any recognizable fabric. Orion thought the raft was fantastic, a genuine adventure waiting to happen. Tochi expressed its usual quiet approval for their endeavors. That just left Ozzy feeling like the one who had to tell them Father Christmas wasn't real. He kept thinking it was something a bunch of 8-year-olds would build over a long, boring summer. Ozzy picked up his backpack, and the three of them headed back inland to look for more fruit. There were several types they'd discovered on the island, all of them found on bushes and mini-palms that grew close to the shoreline. He was soon snipping them off their stalks with his pocket knife and filling the backpack. Orion and Tochi were rustling through the thick vegetation on either side of him. They were both excited at the prospect of leaving the island. Ozzy wished he could share their mood. Every time he gazed up at the gas halo, he knew something here didn't make sense. Why build such a phenomenal artifact, and then stick something as mundane as a planet in the middle of it? The gas halo was surely intended for life that could fly, God's own aviary. The water spheres and Johansson's airborne coral reefs were way stations for creatures that had no need of gravity, that lived as physically free as it was possible to do. He supposed that if the true core of the Sylphan civilization had a physical location, it couldn't have created a more appropriate home for itself. An entire universe that is so small, yet so large within, that it can never be known, Johansson had said of it, a haven of mystery cloaked in the pinnacle of scientific development. How I marveled at such a paradox. Ozzy struggled to remember what else the man had said. Something practical, at least. But Johansson hadn't been one to deal in specifics, though there had been the intimation that he'd returned directly to the Commonwealth from here. It took Ozzy about 40 minutes to fill his backpack. This ought to be enough, he said. Groovy, Orion said with a grin, biting into one of the dark, purple fruits that was flavored like a mild raspberry. The thick juice dribbled over his lips, and he wiped it away with the back of his hand. Ozzy took a moment to look at the boy. Orion was just wearing a pair of ragged shorts, cut off from an old pair of trousers. He was nothing like as skinny as when they started off down the paths too many months ago. The walking and physical work had put a lot of muscle on him. His pale skin was heavily freckled, partially sunburned, slightly tanned, and of late almost permanently dirty. Wispy hair from his first beard was curling around his chin, while his ginger hair was fizzing outward in knotted strings that were beginning to rival Ozzy's own afro for unruliness. In short, he was becoming a proper little savage. All he needed was a spear and a loincloth, and 3 millennia of human civilization would have passed him by completely. My fault, Ozzy thought guiltily. I should have been firmer with him at the start, sent him back to Lidington, or failing that, insisted on some kind of schooling. What? Orion asked, looking around to see what Ozzy was staring at. When did you wash last?
I had a swim this morning.
With soap and water.
There's none left. You said it weighed too much to carry from the ice citadel.
Oh yeah, right. What about tooth gel? Have you been using any?
There's only one tube left, and it's yours. My teeth are fine. What is this?
We need to do something about your hair. There's things living in it, man.
Speak for yourself.
Ozzy pulled at his beard, suddenly very conscious of the example he'd been setting. All right. Tomorrow we both start getting back into the personal hygiene groove. Deal?
Whatever.
Orion shrugged with indifference. Ozzy thought it was a near-perfect imitation of his own don't-care gesture. Good. Then there's some files on the handheld array I'd like to go through with you.
What kind of stuff?
Some background information,
Ozzy said vaguely. You can read, can't you?
Ozzy!
Okay, man, just checking. Tomorrow then, yeah? We're taking off tomorrow morning, you said.
I know. There's not going to be much else to do on the raft, is there?
Orion scratched at his hair, obviously perplexed by this new Ozzy.
Guess not.
They'd set up camp on the beach where they built the raft. Ozzy and Orion used the tent to give themselves a degree of darkness when they wanted to sleep. The constant light didn't seem to bother Tochi, but then the alien didn't sleep anyway. It just rested. When they got back, Orion set about rekindling the fire, then started cooking the fish that Tochi had caught. Ozzy went down to the water's edge and used the filter pump to fill up all their water pouches. The sea wasn't particularly salty, but they certainly couldn't drink it neat. He started packing their things up while Orion finished cooking. The plan was simple enough. When he and the boy woke up, they'd launched the raft straight away. They had enough fruit and cured fish to last them for several days, and drinking water wasn't a problem with the filter. Ozzy was quietly hoping all their preparations would be unneeded anyway, even if, as he strongly suspected, their sail was next to useless. They had carved some crude oars, and Tochi could always tow them along. It surely wouldn't take them more than a couple of days at most to reach the next island. In the morning, he made sure Orion used some of the dwindling tooth gel. Then they both set about combing knots and tangles out of their hair. Ozzy started in on his beard with his razor set, just about the only luxury item he'd hung on to. The diamond-coated blade made easy work of the growth, although he cursed the lack of a decent mirror.
Why don't you just use the handheld array? Orion asked.
He touched a few icons and held it up in front of Ozzy. The screen had unfolded to show the camera image directly. Ozzy's face was magnified considerably.
Thanks, man, he said as he started to apply the razor again, a little bit more skillfully this time. Maybe it wouldn't be too hard to school the boy after all.
After a quick breakfast, they packed all their travel kit away in the rucksacks and various bags, then put all the food they'd gathered for the voyage into wicker baskets. All three of them lined up along the bank of the raft. They'd built it a few yards from the edge of the placid water in anticipation of this moment. With Tochi in the middle, they started pushing, sliding the craft over the soft sand and down into the water. Ozzy was straining hard when the front end finally met the small wavelets lapping ashore. He almost didn't want to watch. If the damn thing sank, he didn't have a clue what they'd do next. The raft dipped alarmingly as its front half rode down the slope below the water, then slowly bobbed up again. Ozzy waded out to his waist, easing it forward. Tochi swam around it, then disappeared underwater. The first day on the island, the big alien had surprised them with its grace in the water. It was almost as though Tochi was more at home in the sea than it was on land. Both sets of malleable flesh flattened out to form long fins that could propel it along at considerable speed, and it could hold its breath for a long time. The result was a constant supply of local fish that it had chased down and caught for them. Orion stood with the water over his knees, grinning proudly at the raft.
Isn't that amazing, Ozzy?
Yeah, man, goddamn amazing.
Ozzy watched their craft for a while longer, still expecting it to sink. It wasn't quite as high above the water as he would have liked, and it was going to be really low when they loaded it up. But it floated. 22 yards away, Tochi flew out of the water and half rolled in the air before splashing down amid a huge burst of spray.
Guess it approves, Ozzy muttered.
He walked back out of the water, holding on to the painter, and wrapped it around a stake they'd hammered into the sand beside the pile of their belongings.
Come on, man. Let's get it loaded up.
Orion waded out of the water.
Ozzy, what are we going to call it?
Huh?
The raft. What are we going to call it? Every boat has to have a name.
Ozzy opened his mouth. The sheer desperation. Titanic 2.
Orion was waiting, looking at him with that naive expectancy of his. And they'd spent days of hard, painful labor building the damn thing.
I'm not sure, Ozzy said.
How about Pathfinder?
Gosh, that's really good, Ozzy. I like it.
He bowed at the raft.
I named this ship the Pathfinder. God bless her and all who sail on her.
God help all those who sail on her more like. Okay, let's get our stuff on board. He picked up a couple of the wicker baskets and waded back out again. They had everything loaded in 15 minutes. Tochi emerged from the water, its multicolored feather fronds glistening under the bright sunlight. It shook itself furiously, scattering droplets in a wide shower.
Are we ready?
It asked through the array. Can't think of any reason to stay, Ozzy said. The Pathfinder wobbled about alarmingly as they hauled themselves up onto the rickety decking, especially when Tochi squeezed up over the side. Ozzy checked the buoyancy again. The water was almost up to the decking, but they were still floating. He could see small fish swimming underneath them. But it's not the small ones I'm worried about. All right, crew, places, please. Ozzy sat down on one side. Tochi claimed the middle, and Orion sat on the other side. They all got their oars out and started rowing. Progress was fairly pitiful at first. Then Ozzy started calling out a rhythm, and they learned how to coordinate their strokes. When they were 110 yards from the shore, Ozzy could feel the breeze against his face. Enough, he said. Let's see if the sail works. He and Orion pulled on the ropes, raising the rough square of woven fronds on the 4.5-yard mast, which had once been the tallest tree on the island. There was a lot of creaking as the ropes took the strain. The swell had grown considerably as they left the lee of the island. Orion was giving the beach a wistful look.
Are we moving?
Tochi's manipulator flesh extended a tentacle, and it poked the tip into the water. We move.
Yay!
Orion clapped his hands happily. He immediately looked ahead, where there were several of the small dark smudges that were other islands in the archipelago.
Which one are we heading for?
Good question, Ozzy said. Tochi, can you try steering us to the second from the left? I thought that was the closest.
I will endeavor that, Tochi said.
It lowered the rudder into the water at the back of the raft, a broad wooden paddle on a crude pivot that they'd rigged up. Now they were farther from the shore. Ozzy was aware of a definite wind pushing them along. He sat on the side, with his feet dangling in the water, and watched the island slowly shrink away behind them. Civilization was a blessing you never truly appreciated until it threatened to collapse around you. That long, long day on Ilan had shown Melanie how precariously close a collapse could be. Fear brought out a very strong survival trait in people, one that overwhelmed all the usual rules of behavior. She was never going to forget those last hours standing beside the small wormhole in the Turquino Valley. The way the crowd had started to panic, everyone pushing forward, their desperation and ferocity building. And that was with a strong character like Simon Rand holding things together. Yet now, barely a week later, it all seemed so remote. She was standing at the window wall in Alessandra's penthouse on the skyscraper's 65th floor, looking out over Salamanca. Cities at night always looked more vibrant, somehow, and New Iberia's capital was no exception. This was a rich world, among the first of Phase One space to be settled, with a population now closing on 2 billion. Salamanca alone was home to 12 million souls. Its light sparkled all the way out to the horizon. Here in the center, where the height of the metal and crystal skyscrapers was a real estate value prospectus, the streets were arranged in a standard grid. Beyond that, the patterns became more random until they merged into the general light pollution that hazed the outlying districts. Cutting through the precise lambent lines was the inevitable radial web of silver rails, threading straight through the grid blocks and bridging roads, always given preference, so that the trains could shunt their valuable goods between districts and the CST planetary station. It might have been her imagination, but she didn't think there were as many trains as usual rolling along the rails tonight. But then just about every activity in the Commonwealth had come to a halt during the invasion. Things were only just starting to return to an approximation of the old normality. When she raised her gaze, she could just make out the ephemeral shimmer of the force field above and around the city. It seemed strange to see it there, fuzzing the stars above. Even though most major cities had them, they'd never been switched on except to ward off the most vigorous hurricanes and tornadoes. Now they were all on permanently. It's still the same, isn't it? Alessandra said,
coming up to stand behind Melanie. Somehow I was expecting changes when I got back. But it's wonderfully reassuring to see. I've stood here for hours myself just watching. It had taken several days before CST resumed its standard passenger service between planets. Millions of refugees from the invaded worlds were given priority as they sought accommodation throughout the rest of the Commonwealth. Wessex still hadn't returned to full operational capacity. CST was busy repairing the wormhole generators that had been damaged during Nigel Sheldon's battle of exotic energy above the planet. Services to that whole section of Phase 2 space remained patchy, though its worlds were still connected to the Unisphere. But the express train between Augusta and New Iberia had resumed, allowing Alessandra to return home 3 days after the Desperado's final flight. This was the first time Melanie had come back to Alessandra's penthouse. She and the last of the Rantown refugees had finally left Ozzy's bizarre asteroid 2 days ago, walking through the wormhole that had been realigned on Augusta. The intervening time had been spent with Dudley, reassuring him and taking a break to compose herself. With all the SI's inserts now quiescent, her newfound confidence had receded somewhat. She wasn't sure what kind of shape her investigation into Mayo and the Starflyer would take. Dudley probably had more information lurking amid his confused memories. It would take a while to be sure she'd gotten everything she needed from him. For now, he was safely stashed away in a cheap coastal holiday resort chalet on Oak Tier, a place where she'd spent many early childhood vacations. Nobody would be able to trace him there, at least not straight away. Alessandra's hands slid over Melanie's shoulders. "We've been hearing some strange stories from the Rantown refugees. Some of them say they were in an alien starship." "They're lying. It was an old dormitory station for a deep space industrial facility that CST is decommissioning. The wormhole was still working, luckily." "Interesting." Alessandra's grip tightened, giving a small massage. "That's the only part of the whole invasion that senior management prevented us from carrying. None of the other media companies carried it either. Somebody's been putting pressure on, and that's a hell of a lot of pressure." Melanie turned to face her, looking intently at the statuesque woman's perfect classic features. "Not guilty." "Hmm." Alessandra stroked a finger lightly along Melanie's cheek. "You've changed." "I was there on the ground when we got invaded by aliens. It kind of makes you focus, you know?" "I'm sure it does, darling." She leaned forward for a kiss. Melanie put her hand out. "Not yet." "Oh, really?" One of Alessandra's elegantly plucked and shaped eyebrows rose slightly. "Well, you'd better get yourself in the mood pretty quickly. I've got Robin Dalsall coming over later for dinner. He's Goldreich's senior aide. I need to know how much money the executive is planning on pumping into the Navy for our retaliatory strike. The two of you should be good together. He's only 10 years out of rejuve." "Fuck him yourself," Melanie growled. "Melanie, darling, I don't do that anymore. I don't need to. I have you to do it for me." "You and 50 others. "Fine, call one of them." "We've had this discussion before. It's starting to get boring." "I don't care about the Navy budget. It's hardly going to be a secret. They'll tell us as soon as it goes to the Senate." "God help us, darling. It's not that we will know, it's when we know. I'm the best because I can break news first." "But what about my story?" Melanie almost shouted. "That's the only one that counts. For God's sake, we've just been invaded, and we can track down the cause. There is nothing bigger than that. I came here to find out who my research team is, when we can start, not to suck some ass-wiper's dick for you." Alessandra frowned. "What are you talking about?" "The Starflyer," Melanie hissed. "I'm going to track it down." "Oh, that nonsense." Alessandra put her hand on her brow theatrically. "You're wrong. I had it checked out for you. Cox Educational is completely legit and still going strong. I think Bunny actually talked to one of the trustees, Ms. Daltra. She assured us their funding is all above board. The accounts are filed with the charity commissioners every 18 months as required. Take a look at them if you want." "What?" Melanie couldn't believe what she was hearing. "You were wrong, darling. No big deal.
We all make mistakes on the way up. If you want my advice, you should stop screwing Dudley Bowes. He's got a lot of psychological problems.
Relifers generally do.
They get over them eventually.
No.
Melanie shook her head.
No. That's wrong. Dudley only...
She trailed off as the real shock hit her, strong enough to raise the goosebumps all along her arms. She gave Alessandra an incredulous stare. It was all she could do not to back away from the woman.
I don't understand.
You made a mistake,
Alessandra told her. Her smile became humorless.
Another one, and I'm not really into this three strikes and you're out crap that the judiciary practices. Frankly, the show's only keeping you on now because of your report from Rantown. That showed promise. But face facts, darling, you're not an investigator. God, you're too dumb even to get to college. Everybody goes to college and gets a degree these days. So let's focus on what you are good at, shaking that shapely little ass of yours at the men I tell you to.
Clear?
Melanie bowed her head and even managed a noise that sounded suspiciously like a sob.
Yes.
Good girl. Alessandra put her hands on either side of Melanie's head and kissed her crown as if performing a blessing. Now why don't you go and put something nice on for Robin? You know he asked for you specially. I think he was impressed by Rantown as well. You're a celebrity now, darling.
All right.
Melanie left the living room, careful to close the door behind her as she went into the penthouse's main hallway.
Are there any special safeguards on the front door? She asked the SI.
Just the standard security systems and alarms.
Great.
She almost bolted to the tall double doors.
They opened for her, and she looked wildly around the marbled vestibule outside. There were only three other doors to the remaining penthouses, two lifts, and the stairwell. Her e-butler interfaced with the skyscraper's management array and told her the lifts were on their way up. She was too worried that Alessandra would follow her out to wait for them, so she went straight to the stairwell and ran downward.
Get a lift to stop for me on the 62nd floor, she told the SI.
It was waiting for her when she burst out of the stairwell. She hopped in and the doors closed.
Lobby, she told the SI. There will be people there. I should be safe.
What is the problem, Melanie?
She pressed her head against the cool metal walls of the lift, waiting for her racing heart to slow.
I never told Alessandra the name of the charity.
It would not be hard for her to discover it.
Run a check on it for me again, please.
The public records have been amended since last week.
God damn.
She glanced up, as if expecting Alessandra to be ripping her way through the top of the lift like some psycho in a bad TSI drama.
They now show the Cox Educational has been in continual operation since its formation, and is still making donations to various science departments. The SI said.
But that's all forgeries, you know that.
We do. But the official records are complete.
How did they do that?
It is not impossible to subvert public records, especially in the finance sector, although the effort involved is considerable.
She tipped them off,
Melanie said out loud.
Alessandra told them I was onto them. Onto it, the Starflyer. It had to be her.
There's no one else.
It's her.
Oh, God. Her legs were trembling the way they had when she was facing the soldier motiles in Rantown.
That is a strong accusation, the SI said.
Are you testing me?
If Alessandra had run a genuine check, she would have found what I told her. The Starflyer would never have had time to cover its alien ass. A fraud this elaborate would take time.
It had to have been given a direct warning so that the cover-up would be in place in case I survived and started yelling allegations. The only person I told was Alessandra.
It is her.
She's working for it, isn't she?
Alessandra is one of the people Johansson warns us about, like the president.
We don't know for certain. However, given the sequence of events, it is highly likely.
The lift doors opened. Melanie peered out into the lobby.
There didn't seem to be anybody waiting for her. She hurried over to the main entrance, where there were some taxis waiting.
I've got to get back to Dudley, she said.
An excellent notion. Then what?
Tell Paula Mayo what I've discovered. Do you know where she is?
Yes.
Casimir stood close to the end of Platform 34 in Rio's planetary station, with people swarming around him as they waited for the next train. The Trans-Earth Loop trains had carried on running almost continually during the invasion crisis, though even that service had stopped when Nigel Sheldon diverted the lunar power to Wessex. But they were up and running again within hours, unlike CST passenger trains to other planets. Casimir had been reassured by the way Earth's infrastructure underwent only the minimum of disruption. What outraged him was the population's attitude. The residents of Santa Monica seemed more upset by the temporary power loss than they did that 23 planets had been lost to alien monsters. And the mayor certainly hadn't allocated any civic buildings to the refugees riding around the intersolar train network looking for accommodation, unlike civic and regional leaders on the other worlds. Earthlings appeared to regard the invasion as just another news event that happened to someone else a long way off. He wasn't sure if that was ignorance or arrogance. Whatever, it was certainly a chilling example of how different their shared mindset was to his own. The last few days had seen at least a degree of awareness creeping in. Casimir had hung around the waterfront in Santa Monica, watching the news in bars, or accessing in his little hotel room, while he waited for things to calm down so he could resume his mission. Local media shows reflected a lot of anxiety that a second wave of planets would suffer invasion, a progression that would one day lead to Earth itself being on the front line. So far there had been no sign of any alien activity anywhere other than on the original invaded worlds. Now the evacuation of civilian populations was effectively complete. Available data was in short supply as the primes continued their inexorable advance. The Navy was maintaining small fighting forces on Anshun, Balkash, and Mataban. Aerobots and professional combat wet-wired troops conducted a guerrilla harassment campaign against the new installations the aliens were constructing. Everyone knew it was a token gesture. The build-up of prime forces was increasing at a disturbing rate as they managed to open gateways on the planetary surfaces. Admiral Keim was expected to order a withdrawal soon, and the final wormholes would be shut down. Analysts on most of the news shows were predicting that the deserted capital cities would then be destroyed by fusion bombs. The Navy's remaining scout ships had returned and were now performing regular flyby patrols of the invaded worlds, supplementing the degraded detector network. So far, the aliens hadn't opened any new wormholes to replace those destroyed by the Desperado's last flight. Some of the technical experts and tacticians on the news shows were hinting that the remaining starships might well be automated, for use in similar relativistic assaults on other prime wormholes. The Navy had publicly refused to comment on the possibility. Commentators were saying that, as the biospheres of the invaded worlds were so badly damaged, the Commonwealth had effectively written them off. It wasn't worth sacrificing their last starships to destroy something humanity would never regain. They were being held in reserve in case of any new assault. Whatever the official reason, that one substantial human victory on the invasion day had already reached an almost legendary status, its crew subject to intense praise on every current affairs and news show. That contrasted sharply with the vitriol and vilification that the rest of the Navy was receiving, along with President Doi's administration. Casimir thought it strange how little mention the wormhole battle above Wessex was getting. It was surely more strategically important than a suicide flight. But then CST's profile in the week that followed was remarkably low. Even under these circumstances, everyone seemed to take their efficiency for granted. The way they moved the refugees around and repaired Narabri Station's gateway was standard stuff for that company. Amber lights flashed above Platform 34, and the loop train slid into the station. 20 double-decker carriages pulled by a Benor AC-767 mag-grip engine. It had been only 5 minutes since the last one pulled out, but there were already over 300 people waiting. The doors opened, and passengers poured out. Casimir held back while everyone else on the platform surged forward impatiently. His eyes moved constantly, checking to see who else loitered. Visual interpretation programs reviewed everything he saw, identifying possibles, tagging them with probability percentages. When he rechecked them, they all turned out to be harmless. It was a wearying process, but he'd stuck with it the whole time on the way back from the ancient observatory in the Andes. The journey had involved 8 vehicle changes,
from his hired 4x4 that he'd driven up into the mountains, to taxis, various local trains, bus, the plane back over to Rio. Every time he'd followed procedure, no matter how foolish it felt, knowing what Stig would say if he lapsed even once. The courier job was vital, as Alvin had never stopped reminding him. The Martian data was essential to the whole Guardian movement. Moving it from South America to the safety of L.A. would probably have gone to Stig if his reprofiling had been completed. As such, Casimir was determined there would be no hitch or glitch. He was going to prove to all of them that he was capable of such an important assignment. He stepped onto the loop train just before the doors closed and watched to see who else got on after him. Procedure once again. Except this once, he was uncertain. Some itchy little feeling nudged at his subconscious. Something made him uneasy. Nobody he could see was the cause of it. Had it been a pattern? If he was being boxed, then at least two of the team would have stayed on the platform. Turning casually, he scanned through the window to see who was left outside. But there were just the late arrivals, wearing expressions of disgust or resignation as they saw the doors closing in front of them. He sent his message to a one-time Unisphere address. Back in the Lemuel's Max Transit office, they would know he was on the last leg. They would be scanning the electronic activity in the train to see if any kind of covert operation was underway. If there was, he'd know about it at L.A. Galactic, just like Stig coming back from Oaktier. Satisfied he'd done all he could, he walked down several carriages before taking a seat, close to an exit. The next stop was Mexico City, then he'd be back at L.A. Galactic. Alvin had emphasized again and again how important this data was to the whole Guardian movement, how he absolutely must not fail. The invasion added its own emphasis. He debated if that was making him paranoid in his desperation to make sure he delivered. As the train pulled away from the platform, he wondered how Stig would look when he got back. The cellular reprofiling should be almost finished, giving him a whole new face, allowing him to resume frontline duties. Stig wasn't good at sitting around doing nothing all day in the safe house. Justine sat at the back of the security office in L.A. Galactic, quietly watching the Navy intelligence team coordinate the box operation on the loop train. They had been running the observation operation from here as soon as they confirmed that Casimir was staying at a hotel in Santa Monica. She checked in with them several times a day for a personal briefing, even at the height of the invasion. Each day was the same. Casimir was killing time, acting like a tourist. Waiting. It was so strange, being able to see the observation team's real-time images of him, while not being able to touch him or talk to him herself. She felt as if she'd been cast in the role of some obscure guardian angel, watching over her beloved from a lofty height, making sure his youthfulness and naivete didn't bring him into harm. The guilt, she felt, at the same time, was excruciating, but she kept telling herself that, afterward, he'd understand. When he finally realized how utterly wrong he'd been, how he'd been taken in and used by others, they could begin afresh. Justine hadn't even thought what kind of life they'd have together afterward, which made her as dizzy-headed as Casimir. Then yesterday the call had come through from Commander Alec Hogan. Casimir had received instructions from a one-time address and taken the loop train to Rio. What followed then had been strange. Casimir had visited an ancient observatory in the Andes, then set off back almost immediately. Given how isolated the observatory was, the Navy team couldn't get inside to see what it was Casimir had picked up. In fact, it was very difficult for them to remain unseen on the track through the Andes as they followed his 4x4. Low-level cybersphere investigation revealed the observatory was run by a consortium of universities, with funding coming from a great many sources, corporate, government, and educational. It was now surrounded by a Navy team, who were waiting for the order to go in. That would only come after Casimir delivered whatever he was carrying to his controller. The scale and obvious importance of the whole operation was easy justification for her to travel to L.A. Galactic in person, along with two bodyguards from Senate Security. Hogan was running the operation himself, as well he might, considering the pressure she'd been putting on him.
"The loop train has left Rio, Senator," Hogan reported. "Shouldn't be much longer now."
"Good."
"He called a one-time address once he egressed.
The Guardian operative returning from Oak Tier did the same thing. It would seem to be their standard operating procedure.
Do you expect Casimir McFoster to get off here?
It's highly probable, but I've got enough people to box him no matter where he goes.
Don't worry, Senator. This one won't be getting away from us.
I'm glad to hear it. She gave him a slight nod, dismissing him. Hogan's smile was forced as he went back to join his team. All of them were hunched over their desks, studying the screens and muttering to the field operatives. This time nothing was left to chance, as it had been when Paul Amayo was in charge. Over 100 naval intelligence officers were on duty in and around L.A. Galactic, ready to trail Casimir to whatever destination the handover was scheduled to take place. They'd been quietly deployed over the last 2 days, avoiding any possibility of virtual observation. Tarlo was convinced their last failure was due to the Guardians infiltrating at least some of L.A. Galactic's network. Consequentially, they were using dedicated communication systems with ultramodern obscured traffic software. If the Guardians had the technical capability to detect that, then they'd probably be running the whole Commonwealth before the end of the year. She used her interface to call up images from the CST internal network and watched on a desk screen as the loop train slid through the gateway between Rio and Mexico City. Casimir got off the loop train at LA Galactic's Caralvo Terminal. It was midday. Undiluted sunlight poured through the huge crescent windows high overhead, making the angular support pillars gleam. He walked off the platform and down the curving ramp at the end, feeling the familiar tremble through the soles of his boots as trains rolled through the giant building. Traffic at the station was almost back up to its pre-invasion levels, though noticeably fewer passengers crowded the central concourse. As he stepped off the end of the ramp, he glanced about casually, as if unsure which way he should be going. Nobody paid him any attention. There had been no warning from the Guardian team, either visually or through the cybersphere. Maybe I am paranoid. Casimir started walking along the concourse, heading for exit 8, where there was a taxi stand outside. Another quarter of an hour would see him return in triumph to the office of Lemuel's Max Transit and hand over the memory crystal with its Martian data. He almost patted the little disk in its secure belt pocket, but that would have been pathetically amateurish. A confident smile tweaked his lips as he made his way through the thousands of travelers bustling along the central concourse. The Guardians would be another significant step toward bringing about Faraway's revenge because of him, and once this mission was complete, he would try to find time to visit Justine again. That venture out the Tulip Mansion was the only thing he'd done since leaving Faraway that transgressed their operational doctrine, but he didn't care. Bruce would understand that, if none of the others did. Justine was a part of him. Without her, there was no point to existence. She was worth risking everything for. And when he'd seen her again that fateful night, it was as if no time had passed. That she felt the same way about him was the kind of miracle he wouldn't even expect the dreaming heavens to grant. But she did. That was the true wonder he'd known. She felt for him as he did for her. Her delight alone made him more determined to rid the universe of the Starflyer. He wanted a universe where nothing could come between them ever again. What a world that would be. What an incredible, blissful future. He was 200 meters away from exit 8 when he saw the man standing at the bottom of the ramp that curved up to platform 6. Something about him. Neatly cropped hair. Tall, young, early 20s just like Casimir, wearing a simple blue jacket over a cream shirt. The way he was standing, holding a small array in his hand, reading a document on the unrolled screen. His position and angle against the ramp's railing, so relaxed and natural, allowed him to see everyone walking along the concourse whenever he happened to glance up from the screen. It could so easily have been an ordinary civilian. But his profile made Casimir slow as he approached. That profile was oddly familiar. A profile that was searing connections deep into Casimir's brain. Old memories tumbled out, delivering a physical jolt to the body. Casimir halted. Tears smudged his vision.
No,
he said soundlessly. He wanted to move, but his knees were threatening to give way. The man glanced up from the array screen,
looking straight at Casimir.
"Bruce," Casimir gasped. "It's you."
He took a step forward, heedless of the people flowing between them. It was him, really him. Bruce McFoster, standing on the concourse on L.A. Galactic, as if it were the most normal thing in the universe. Bruce McFoster, who had fallen in battle right in front of him. Every day Casimir saw the giant warhorse rolling across Bruce's defenseless body. Bruce McFoster, alive.
"Bruce!"
Casimir took another couple of steps.
"Oh my God, Bruce, it's me, it's Kaz!"
Bruce hadn't stopped looking at him. He put the array in his pocket with a calm, unhurried motion. Casimir started running.
"Bruce!"
He opened his arms wide in rapturous welcome. A path opened for him through the crowd as he rushed forward. Bruce McFoster brought his right arm up. There was something in his hand. It flashed. Casimir felt no pain. He felt nothing. There had been a moment of blackness. Then he was looking straight up at the Coralvo Terminal's white concrete ceiling far overhead. His body wasn't moving. Silence closed on him.
"Bruce?"
Faces swam over him, but it was hard to see any of them. The light was dimming. Casimir tried to smile. He finally realized he was dying. Not that it mattered, because his life had included...
Justine.
Ghostly fingers reached up to touch her icon.
"Justine, I'm so sorry."
But her smile was there, comforting him, forgiving as the light slipped away. Justine screamed as the security camera swung around on the man Casimir was staring at in such wondrous disbelief. Her brother's murderer was standing in the middle of L.A. Galactic. She watched as he coolly raised his arm and fired a pistol. The ion stream blew Casimir's chest open in a horrific plume of blood and charred gore. He was flung back 5 meters through the air to sprawl on the concourse. Justine screamed, choked off. She almost dropped out of the chair as her body spasmed in shock. The Navy team filled the office with frenzied shouting. A furious, scared Alec Hogan was almost sobbing as he ordered the officers on the concourse to give chase. His fists were clenched above the main screens, ready to punch straight through the images. Every picture turned to a confused, fast-moving blur. More shots were fired. A chorus of yelling and panicked shrieks burst out of the speakers. Justine breathed again. A long, juddering breath that burned its way down her throat. One screen had remained centered on Casimir's broken body.
"Take me down there," she whispered painfully.
"Senator?" one of the bodyguards asked.
"We're going down there."
"Yes, Senator." Her e-butler told her a single message had arrived via a one-time address. Its author was verified as Casimir McFoster.
"Nobody's to touch him," she yelled abruptly as she got to her feet.
The Navy personnel turned around from their desks, looking at her with startled expressions.
"Keep everyone away from him," she told them.
"I don't want him touched." As she left the office, she ordered her e-butler to open the message. It contained a Unisphere address code and a line of text.
"My darling Justine, you are the only person I have ever loved. I thank you for living. Casimir."
The bodyguard had to hold her as she started crying. CST station security staff cleared a path for Justine through the tense, worried crowd on the concourse. They'd been kept well back from the body, leaving her with a long, lonely walk at the end. The last few steps, as the true damage that had been done to him became visible, were almost impossible for her. Yet she forced herself forward, punishing herself because she knew she deserved far, far worse. It was every bit as bad as she knew it would be, the blood pooling over the white marble. The smell, his face perfectly intact, holding the expression of someone whose prayer had been answered. Justine knelt beside him, though in truth her legs could barely hold her weight anymore. The wide puddle of his cold blood soaked into her expensive skirt. She reached out and touched his cheek with her fingers, fearful of what she would feel. Lifeless bodies she had seen countless times, including her brother's. But Casimir was a guardian. He didn't have a memory cell insert. This was genuine death, a life that had ended. She thought she'd left this barbarity behind centuries ago.
Later, there would be anger, fury, and a bitter, bitter remorse. For now, she was just numb. Not understanding how this could have happened, despite all her power and authority, all the orders and thinly veiled threats, that nothing, nothing was to harm him. Now here he was, her beautiful young love, dead, forever. Justine heard a pair of heels clicking on the marble, someone walking purposefully along the concourse toward her. No doubt who that would be. She smiled forlornly down at Casimir one last time, then rose to her feet and turned around.
"Senator," Paula Mayo said, "my sympathies."
Justine's smile turned cruel as she glanced down at the dark blood staining her skirt.
"I told them. I made it very clear to the Navy. Casimir was not to be hurt.
The Navy didn't do this.
You see, I always thought that I was right, that he was just a naive provincial lad with a head full of nonsense. I have to be right, because I'm nearly 4 centuries old, and I live in mansions and penthouses, and I have enough money to buy his world.
I had to protect him from himself, from others who were using him.
You did everything you could.
Then why is he dead, Investigator?
There is a leak in the Navy, probably more than one.
It is real, isn't it? She said with a kind of detached amusement. Casimir was right all along.
Yes, Senator, the Starflyer is real.
Wind and current were acting in happy conjunction, pushing the Pathfinder along at a steady clip. In other circumstances, Ozzy would have been quite pleased about that. But not today.
"Isn't there anything ahead?"
Orion asked with a petulant whine. Ozzy switched off his retinal insert zoom function, which he'd been using to scan that uncomfortably distant horizon. "No," he said. Even he thought he sounded defensive. 15 miles to starboard, and now slightly behind, the last island rose up out of the tranquil blue-gray water. The simple dark green cone was the fourth one they'd tried to reach.
Once they'd left their original island behind, the sea's current had picked up considerably. So much so that they had very little ability to steer.
Even with Tochi angling the rudder hard over, they couldn't vary their course by more than a few degrees. They had missed the first island by over 10 miles, standing on the raft's creaking deck to watch despondently as it sank away behind them. It had been larger than the one they'd set sail from, with wide coves and extensive forests. Ozzy hadn't seen any signs of habitation, even with his retinal inserts on full magnification. But it had looked very promising. After the shock of missing landfall, they had swung around straight away for the next island, 30 miles farther on. This time, with near constant rowing and the tiller jammed over, they'd got to within a couple of miles as the current swept them onward. Neither of the two exhausted humans had said anything, but they both knew that Tochi could have swum ashore if it wanted to. Their big alien companion had chosen to stay with them. From then on, there were fewer islands they could aim for, and the current strength had increased noticeably, and now what might have been their last chance was receding at a respectable speed. Ozzy sat down with his back to the mast, looking back, trying not to appear too disappointed. The stiff square of sail was curved tautly as the breeze pushed against it. There wasn't a lot of point having it up anymore. The surface of the sea was flowing as fast as a plains river. He couldn't work out why it was doing that, either. Sea simply didn't rush about. There was no hydrological mechanism he could think of that would produce such an effect. It was just one more anomaly that the planet had thrown at them. Ozzy worried that it might prove a fatal one.
"I might be able to tow us back over to the last island,"
Tochi's array translated. Ozzy gave the big creature a dubious look. "You're more likely to just wear yourself out. Let's save acts like that until we get desperate."
"And we're not now," Orion muttered.
"As long as we're moving, we're okay," Ozzy said firmly. "There will be more islands over the horizon, or even the mainland. It's when we stop moving that we're in trouble."
Orion's expression was very skeptical, but he didn't argue. Tochi pulled the rudder up, then simply shuffled around until it was facing forward.
So far, they'd eaten about a third of their fresh supplies, Ozzy calculated. If they were a little more careful from now on, the fruit should last them another 4 or 5 days. Technically, food wasn't a problem,
Tochi could catch fish for them indefinitely, and their filter pump could produce fresh water. From that point of view, they could sail over the entire ocean. However, he was under no illusion about how long the raft would last. The palm frond ropes were already showing signs of swelling and fraying where they bound the log bundles together. When they started to go, their future would be measurable in hours. There were no life belts on board. He was now wondering how useful the inflatable tent walls would be in an emergency. Ozzy woke with Orion shaking his shoulder.
Ozzy, I can hear something.
The boy's voice was low, as if he was afraid.
Okay.
Ozzy pushed his sunglasses up, blinking around. He hadn't meant to fall asleep. When he looked behind them, there was a small trail of bubbles emerging from the stern of the raft.
Jeez, we're leaving awake. How fast are we going? Don't know.
Orion was still subdued. Ozzy climbed to his feet, very conscious of the wind. The sail was straining hard, applying a lot of force to the mast. Let's get that down, he said. He and Orion untied the ropes and lowered the dry, grey-brown square. It flapped away enthusiastically as it came down.
Is there a cause for concern? Tochi asked.
Orion thought he heard something, Ozzy said.
Are air vibrations a danger?
Depends what's making them, Ozzy said. Even after all this time, with their expanded vocabulary and literally days devoted to explaining the topic, Tochi still had difficulty with the whole concept of noise.
Can you hear it? Orion asked.
Ozzy stood still. There was a distinct sound carrying over the water, just loud enough to be heard above the wavelets that lapped against the Pathfinder. A reverberant grumbling like distant thunder. When Ozzy looked forward, trying to pinpoint the sound, he saw the horizon had become indistinct. A thin blanket of fog lay over the water. He zoomed in with his retinal inserts, which revealed nothing. The sound was gradually getting louder.
I think we should tie ourselves on, Ozzy said, just in case. What is it?
Orion asked.
Please, Ozzy.
I don't know, man, honestly. I'm just taking some precautions here. We're a long way from land, and if this is a storm brewing up, I don't want anyone going overboard.
They busied themselves with some lengths of rope, lashing the ends to the base of the mast.
Tochi declined a rope, using its locomotion flesh ridges to anchor itself to the decking. When they'd finished, the fog bank was a lot closer, and the noise had become a constant soft roar that continued to build.
Ozzy stood beside the mast, hooking one arm around the tall shaft of wood.
I don't get it, he complained. I can't see any storm clouds anywhere. Above him in the clear sky, the water specks in the gas halo gleamed with their usual intensity. The sea around them was becoming choppy, with waves rushing forward in unison, carrying the Pathfinder onward. They were starting to rock about from the speed they were traveling. The creaking of overstrained ropes was audible above the roaring. Several new water specks rose above the horizon, like small constellations on the move. Ozzy stared at them in puzzlement. Something very weird was happening to his sense of perspective. It was as if the fog bank was shrinking, while the horizon rushed in toward him. Then, in a moment of truly terrifying revelation, he realized what he was seeing. There was no fog bank. It was just a thin line of spray hanging above the waves. Spray thrown up by a waterfall. The sea was pouring over a cliff that extended out to the vanishing point on either side of the Pathfinder. White water boiled up directly ahead of the raft, its vigorous spume drenching Ozzy. The raft tilted alarmingly as it juddered over the churning water, forcing him to cling to the mast as his feet slipped. Looking to starboard, he could see the entire sea cascading down in a vast arc that thundered farther and farther toward. There was no bottom beneath them, only the empty void of the gas halo. Ozzy lifted his head back to stare at the false stars above, his face a mask of incredulity and pure rage.
You've gotta be fucking kidding me!
He screamed at the sky. The Pathfinder fell off the edge of the world.